quote from Rumi. He said, "Let the beauty we love be what we do." So let the beauty we love be what we do tonight. And I came in at an open mic now, Joe Sweeney. The first up is Joe Sweeney.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I wanted to read a little more from an extract from a work that I'm present working on. It's a series of letters, and it's written by a teacher. Her name is Maeve Gonal, and she's working in this school. She's kind of upper class, and she's working in an inner city school, which is rather quite difficult for her. And so she, in order to cope, she just writes letters to the principal. "Dear Principal, 948, thank you for consistently not replying to my letters. It's good to know in a changing world that something can be relied upon. Perhaps you wish me to be independent, all to the good. Or is it perhaps some form of subtle message? You are certainly showing great restraint. I wish I had your secret, you know, and could remain cool like you while all around me are cracking up. If only I had an office like you where I could hide when the going gets rough. I am currently trying to emulate your superb indifference, but in the rough and tumble of the classroom, sadly literal, it is proving a continuous challenge. I may soon need Valium. 952. Have just learned from Miss Ryan, as she retreated down the corridor, pursued by that crowd of ragamuffins in 6B, that you are unable to come to the classroom as you are still in conversation with Mr. Boyle. Would Mr. Boyle be the father of Darren Boyle, by any chance, who was hurling the billiard balls at teachers' cars last week? My own car was one of those damaged, and I am hoping for compensation. So, dear Principal, if you get a moment, could you bring that to Mr. Boyle's attention? 955. Just another quick note to keep you up to speed on what has been happening in the class since I last had a chance to record it for posterity. I'm happy to report that since his re-entry into class from the window ledge, Johnny Evans has settled down a little. Whether this is because his character has reformed or the effect of fright, I'm not sure as yet. He looks a little dizzy, slightly green in colour, and quite frankly, I've never known him to be so quiet in class before. It's unnatural. I keep a close eye on him just to see how he is getting on. It does strike me, you know, how adept Johnny is at getting on, you know. He spends most of the time getting on to window ledges and getting on my nerves. He's quite gifted in this area. Where does he get off? That's what I would like to know. Anyway, El Principale, rest easy with regard to everything here. With my sharp spectacles, I never missed anything or anyone in my last school, St. Jude's. I hardly ever miss today. I certainly never miss the pupils. I may occasionally miss one of them with the duster as he ran too quickly out the door, but generally speaking, nothing ever got by me. It was St. Jude's in Ballymun, and it is, as you now know, sadly closed down. The sisters concluded that even given the perennial hope of St. Jude's intervention on behalf of the children, teaching there was genuinely hopeless. The number of casualties in that school was just unreal. The local social workers were demented. The hospital just couldn't cope, and that was only the teachers. The local dentist was happy enough, though he was doing a great trade in fixing or pulling broken teeth. The local undertaker was also very chipper. He was doing a marvellous trade with every new fatality. He found fresh vigour and hope to go on. 10:25. Good news at last, Principal. Good news. I am just about to leave the classroom for the morning break. I have successfully prevented young Evans from getting out the window. I found this piece of rope in the locker and, well, I won't go into the details now. And there's also good news on the O'Driscoll versus O'Connor front. They had been rolling about on the floor, their bodies entangled. Nothing but shooting boots and flailing fists were visible for some time. But now as I write, the bell is ringing and the pair of them appeared to have agreed on a cessation of hostilities. It is probably only temporary, but welcome nonetheless. I am now evacuating the class for the morning break. By the way, how are we getting on with Mr. Boyle, Principal? Can I hold out any hopes of compensation there? I'll keep you informed of developments throughout the day. Please do likewise. Yours, etc. Ever alert, May Eagle.
Good morning to our kid in Eleanor, Henry Gardner.
Thank you for having me.
It is that love you gave me, that frivolity of life, that kept those stars in the sky, that made the ashes rise up. Oh my God, what a gift to get. You, which have been critical to me, make me smile and burst into laughter. It is in that moment and in that time, as the dove settles, that I fell in love with you all over again. I sit in silence, watching a frozen lake melting with my mind, melting each layer with my eyes closed and my heart pounding, ta-dum, ta-dum. As I see your lips touch mine, as I wrap my soul around yours, passion, lust, grabbing, holding, ta-dum, ta-dum. I can't get enough, tasting, touching, stop, break away. A smile pulling us back together, I kiss, a soft caress, melting, melting. I open my eyes, lazy and lingering. I now watch the ripples of an unfolding lake, unfolding into waves that come crashing towards, that come crashing down. Ta-dum, ta-dum.
This is him calling, Henry. I'm kidding, I don't know, breathe for you.
The Emperor's new clothes. Sew me up, you button up my soul. With your own has warned you patches in several gaping holes. Stitch me up, you pin needles through my eyes. But a thousand threads and buttons, they could not disguise. The empty spaces where the window to your soul should be. You cannot look at me, you will never see. Rip me up, your work has come undone. I won't be your puppet left outside to dry in scorching sun. Now I've let go, your wool chains fall away, and I try not to laugh with you sitting there in the Emperor's new clothes. This is called stone picking. Scanning for airplanes while I search for stones, we're always looking in different directions. Everyone said she's your daddy's eyes, but when our eyes met between us were skies, I remember you, back bent and sealed, leathery hands scattered with scars. You never complained when the blood bundled, while we'd all run your panicked chickens digging out Ethel in piled up presses. I'll count, you'd say, and off I'd be, taking steps two at a time, always resenting that you never finished your numbers. I still resist them, choosing letters in their stead. Winter days unfurled like cabbages, crunching mother music, weaving feet to doe-eyed calves. Favorite task, feeding them, daddy's little girl, digging out questions from the depths of the ditch. You answered them with pleased patience, getting a gappy grin for your efforts. Gap gaped wider as girl grew up fast, keeping my feminism to myself. At last, the bile blistered my own tongue, mouthing the words of my petty victory. And silence would still speak volumes, pushing up plates, questions sitting unasked. When time came to take lamps to mark, hazy headaches took me. Sheep knew my secrets, tears burned holes in hay. Never fathomed your face, you failing to fight when he arrived early. Stoical like the sick lambs lying down in their grief. Why not stamp the walls of nature's injustice who struck out unbidden with lean smile of fever? Perhaps I was always bound for the city, felt more freedom in lamplight than in dark country lanes. I sail on black gold waters where I had fluttered in hay barns. But sometimes I wake in the fields. Weeds weed long, but I'll not try to tame them. I simply don't have your farmer's hands. My daddy's eyes still scan skies for flames, and I'm still searching for stones. Searching for crimson, your red overalls. I'm peering under stones, I may find poppies or worms. I'll keep looking for crimson, you never spoken language. The earth was your paper, the poppies your heart. I'll keep looking for crimson, you never spoken language. The things that define us are what drive us apart.
degrees. And Kate and Ellen are Jean Barry.
Careful, Jean, we need you on that. Good luck, Ellen. This will be your average list. First poem is called Narcoleptic Father. It's a poem about one of the many moments I've told it with my kids as babies. The winding completed and given up through inhalations of newborn. That these euphoric days seem to grace each corner of our house, infused by your love through its umbilical broadcast. I rewind and rewind as I kiss and kiss again your tiny floppy frame, now resting on a dedicated mould, on a shoulder built for taking tackles, and breathe you into my future as I hear you ask without speech your last, and I answer in a whisper yes. My boy and I, we dance through the instinctual before we swim with you and suddenly bubble dreams and doubt you with our love. Oh, to run the softest cotton over your unborn knuckles, through the neck tracks collecting angel remnants that invitingly give themselves up, yielding to the pleasure of a moment that is mine and yours, to lift you from your soaking manger and swaddle you in my arms, and after drying to hold you naked to my skin and fill the dotted line, to spray your grotto with blankets of white clouds before I dress you. And bonding in the aftermath, my adult returns to whisper in an ear that seems to hear without listening, a host of promises and confessions. My votive deposit decorating the foot of your basket. Thank you. This is a weird one here. When Margot and myself moved into our house 7 years ago, we started to do up the bedroom of the house, and we removed the architrave off the bedroom door, and we found three miraculous medals nailed on in behind the architrave. And we knew there was a lot of fairy wings, fairy forts that were demolished when they were building the house, and we reckon that the carpenter put them up there to protect us. And the idea of a poem was sown then, but I could never quite get it. And last week I was down at the store watching Seamus, listening to Seamus Easy reading, and he read Midterm Break, and this poem delivered itself the following night, so I'll read it. It's called Fairy Ring. What parts of our forefathers sat in the cockpit as we stood in our new bedroom in our old house that was now ours? Were the skirting boards and architraves like out-of-date tatty jewellery begged replacement? I split the jaded paint with my grandfather's chisel, wondering if he had shared shavings with the hands who married it to this doorframe. I peeled it from his partner to reveal a trinity of miraculous medals. No strands of faded light blue from his foreplay, no safety pins, each tiny halo crucified with an uneventful panel pin. The untongued cleft, a waving hand from my old pennies, cast itself into my wondering and seduced my inquisitiveness. How was I to know? Ring-like mules to the pivot of a Mexican well, I saw them dance their circles. The owner of the bumper, Lucipus, and the scarlet, orphous, democratus in tandem. No leader, no follower. Uncaptained anthems carrying the throng through layers of family wanderings and loose tongues, through the moment's unpacked baskets of blessings, their uniforms a daily dose of happiness. I danced no longer than to see that a kiss now sits where a dead poppy lodged. Thank you. I'll just read one more short one for a minute, called Kiss Clopping. Days inside the dark low door where the plates of baby beetroots seem to set themselves a plate at every meal of warm milk and clocks that time ignored. That warm summer when the haycocks like summer's breasts bound in the hot sun dressed to giddy fields, each one curiously, with a corner of where I safely perched as we pit plot to the cobbled yard. I missed the man that was my fall most, I missed them all. I wondered why I was chosen to greet the spraying teeth and cottage innocence. He would reach behind his gravelled mouth that held the morning's weeding in the turnip field, across the minefields of sense and legality and invade, his manky hands to the crotch of us innocent boys. Were they the tickling fingers of a simpleton or the death-grappling hooks of boyhood? My brother said he was a queer. I opened the gate each trip and swung on fear's axis through a multitude of head-spinning questions that I could not pilot. Who was the boy and where were the adults? Thanks very much.
And Kate Danella, no, nice, Harriet. This is a little story called The Dreaming Fires. Dermot was known as the Daydreamer. While the other boys were involved in the rough and tumble of Gaelic football, he wandered the countryside at weekends. His favourite place was the hill at Rathconrath. He liked to bring his book and read about Celtic mythology, for this hill is also the fabled Uisneach, the centre point of Ireland according to the Druids. He read that the centre is where you might find the door half open to the other world, as in the centre of a labyrinth or a stone circle. He also read about the first sacred druidical fire which burned for 7 years on Uisneach, and from which every hilltop fire in Ireland was lit, including on the 1st of May, Balcony. He would lie back on the grass, his head cushioned on a bank of primroses, and gaze out on the hills on the horizon. He would visualise the fires on each hilltop, all the way inside of each other out to the coast, north, south, east and west. On this day he read about the reputation each part of Ireland had in those ancient times. Leinster for making money, Connacht for making myths and magic, Ulster for making war, and Munster for making love, he joked himself. No, Munster for music and poetry. Interesting thought. He put down the book and reflected on what he had been reading about the derivation of the name Balcona. One idea was the immense mouth of fire from the Irish for mouth, Bala, and the Irish for fire, Chinna. This might have been from the custom of purifying the cattle as they were driven out on May Day between two fires to pasture, after being overwintered in the stockade. Smoke was considered a means of purification, just like the smudging rituals of the Native Americans and the ancient Egyptians. Another theory was that the fires lit for this purpose were also dedicated to the deity known as Bel. Could there be a link to Baal in the Near East? The Celtic Galatians from that region were one of the supposed predecessors of the Irish Celts, Irish and Gaelic Celts, possibly through the Milesians after their Iberian trade. Dermot's musings made him drowsy. Soon he was asleep and dreaming vividly. He was being made to walk through thick black smoke across a glowing bed of wood ash. In this he succeeded without pain or injury, and for some reason he did not feel surprised. Now you are chief of the tribe, said the old druid who was supervising the ritual. You have successfully completed the final test for your election. Mother goddess Danu was carrying me, replied Dermot. One day I will unite all the tribes who speak our language, and I will put an end to the cattle raiding. The druid looked at Dermot closely and then nodded. Dermot felt a speech coming on. The Romans have completed the subjugation of our cousins in the mountains just across the water. They are having a lot of difficulties with our other cousins in the cold north of that long island, but we know from our spies they are planning to invade our beloved island of Aerie. We must protect our people or we might end up like our predecessors, the Tuatha De Dananna, driven underground and now merely the people of the sheep. Merely, exclaimed the druid, his big fluffy white eyebrows working furiously. Do not dare to be disrespectful to the she, ever. They can help us, even in battle, like the great shapeshifters they are, but they can also be our worst enemies.
Carmel, Diarmuid's mother, said to the lad as he ambled into the kitchen, "Where in the wide earthly world did you get to? I rang everyone. We were just going to call the guards." "Oh, I fell asleep above on Ushnag." "Ah, you weren't there again," said Tom, his father. "Your head's astray with them books." He sniffed the air, and then he came over and he sniffed near Diarmuid. "Were you smoking, young lad?" Diarmuid thought of his dream. "No, Dad." "But I was smoked," he said with a twinkle in his eye. Better not tell him that he was now chief of the tribe. His father threw his eyes upwards and said to Carmel, "Where did you get him at all? He's not the full shilling, you know." "A throwback, that's what he is," said Diarmuid's grandmother, Molly, gazing at the lad with her cloudy, pale blue eyes. "A throwback from another century." "Yes, my aunt," said Carmel. "Look, Tom, it's just a phase he's going through. He'll grow out of it." "Or maybe he'll grow up to be a druid," said Molly, the grandmother. "We might be needing a few druids again, the way the church has been going." "Ah, sure, Molly, we know you're away with the fairies too," said Tom. The boy was smiling as he took off his boots and socks and rubbed each foot in turn, recalling the strange rite of passage in the vivid dream. His parents looked with concern at the red lifted soles and heels of Diarmuid's feet. "Be the holy," said Tom, "you must have walked to Tara and back this time as well as Ushnag." The boy laughed. "Fire, just like a bit of fire walking, Dad." "Ah, yeah, God love you."
Thanks, Mike. I enjoyed that, Dad.
Yeah.
Next up is Seamus Harrington.
Thanks, Adam. Come sun up, he paused at some crisp, to find the bard literally stiff. The words that he read, a voice from the dead, this horseman passed by in a jiff. -25°4.8' south, 130°6.2' west, Father's Day. Above the tide line, he gazes silently, cloaked in a diamond hard hummock. Like a towering outline on an azure wall, a cargo ship stands off. Containers, provisions at the ready. Bargain hunters lining her rail. He ignores the soft tick-ticking of cooling quad bikes. With a leathery move of ponderous hide, he nods, blinks an elderly eye. He has seen it before. He has seen 500 Father's Days. Kinmare. He met her inside in Kinmare. This lightkeeper knew solitaire. Cause there was no doubt, he had gone without. Her flat had a circular stare. High noon. Cocooned in a gown of dragons, staring, he sits in the hallway, right thumb on a ring, Malacone fading away from the remote day room TV. The other one, cumbersome, dissecting his cardigan, a sandal foot on each wrist, a waft of brown soda, pungent and poignant as cordite. Unaware of the danger, a patron at peace with the world plods between the park chairs, puckers his lips, pockets a tissue of teeth. A kaleidoscopic wall hanging, the stained flash of sunlight, seraphic, sacred and silent. Unblinking, they face one another. Who'll draw that first bead? 20 chrome reds apart, Derringers still trousered, and clumsy bedpan bongs clear as an angelus bell, two right hands lift as one. Surprise. Ding, 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 the spoon on a brandy glass. the murmur dies away. I now present, on behalf of our sponsors, Walter Crystal, first place at this year's Jugglers Convention, goes to Oops! Motorist prayer. Help me, St. Christopher, you're still there, to steer clear of flats, potholes, toll booths, pushy bikers, speed traps, and slow coaches, to await my turn coolly, fumeless from road rage at snarl-ups and traffic calming measures, to drive as if I was to meet myself coming from the opposite direction, to find a fitting parking space in on meter zone, disc and clamp free, amen. Finish with this limerick. A tie. He cultivates lawns round the tie, and he is exceedingly shy. A wee drop of milk, alone, she's in silk, he sees to the flash of a tie. Thank you.
Margaret Seamus, and Kate and Ellen are John Keating.
These are kind of some reworkings of some kind of more teenage stuff, so it might be a bit angsty, but... Feet in the lungs, behind the eye, beneath the tongue, this is madness. Wolf in the woods, cast out from home, this is hunger and sadness. Your birds in the air are not love, your sun in the wind is not love. That and the heat in the eyes and the hunger of wolves, these are feelings of love. Father are lying in the water and do not think of you. Your sons are hypnotized by girls with hypno eyes, they will not think of you. We have to cross and we have to kill, we have the noose and the will to run to the wolves and trees. The heart is hollow in the mother's womb. The father tries to stitch it to himself, soothing its tiny palpitations with a shaking finger, but to break the wall. There are 3 days for Dionysius to learn and live and love everything worth writing about. Instead he rages until he breaks the heart and then back to the soil.
That was lovely, Jack. Thanks. And the next person is Eugene Crowley.
John, yeah. On Chalk Moor. Doing a little deer. Cash down the box. Cleaning the corridor. Jilte. Kusula Arsan. Chinook.
Margaret Eugene, Margaret Calendera, Perla Schneider, Manuel Amiella, it's Paul Casey.
It's weird that I came up here to say it, but I'm especially one this day. I was lucky enough recently to be invited up to Derry to represent Munster in the contention of the bards. There'll be 6 poets, 2 from Munster, myself and Jean Barry, there in the corner. And we each have 15 minutes to read off the page. And this is the poem I'm going to be reading off the page for 15 minutes without the page, but I'm probably going to hold on to it tonight just to be, it's called It's Not All Bad. I saw that devil again on the TV today, preaching away, looking around for prey, didn't have much to say. I didn't say. But what to do, what to do? The feeling next was wonder, hit me like a ton of down. So much cannot be uttered, I thought, with thunder. Some veiled focus, just out of sight, a mixture of desires. I closed my ears to fairies. Earth sees cures my eyes, colors, form, clarity, and pep reform with every step. Inventors, for what else to do are these endeavors while burning deeper still, untouchable will. I run through the emptiness, the layers of joy, life's unwanted gifts, unknowable still, my Troy. The eye that opens my soul without a fire. What must yet be done, or said, or thought? What creatures are these who discover such sufficient meaning and wealth? The very flame who splash with smiles and cast at blissful defense. The very same inhuman who calls us not to rest. What days are these surrounding? What bird would choose this flight? These lords of men are drowning. What is there left to fight? The freedoms gained are heavy might. Heavy light, freedom gained, to know or not to know, to care or feel or think. I run from absence, I run for tomorrow, I run to her, free from napalm, mustard, hate, free for another day, free to try, to be. It said before you die, your whole life flashes by. I open my eye and time, compressed, defiant, flashes everything by. All at once, all this is an emerald question, of course, trapped in a seeking eye, like a stone in your custard, shocking, breaking, unwanted. So what? Where is this talent of mine, this thing which drives me, this thing which drives me lifeward, onward, madward, saneward? What is this seeking thing, this elusive swimming will which mocks and jeers and delights at the confusion of this plight? Stories within, lonely and joyful, dreams about me, wishful, tearful, and I thoughtful. Antenna of the mind, stretch outward again and find those angels and devils alike, spectators of my life. My life, the PC, TV, lingo, muso, celluloid, free flight, gringo, bohemian strings from a poet's wings, awakening phoenix, Chinese whiskey, snowboard, free fall, fantasy, African eagle, English beagle, real Irish regal, frugal, bourgeoisie sort, machine, a cellar of salesmen, a sewer of sewers, a killer of whims, such naive drinkers of Pims, number one, or number 10 of 6 billion odds. How many of them could be numbered? 5/7 of a mathematician? Let Python fly out from Saturn's mirror. Let these numbers float like clouds and endure. Let Sharon stop her floating tango. Let these numbers dance the fandango. Number one, indeed, said Lucifer, that dreary sun. And you'll be number two, yes, done. To which I need reply, not desire. My life, Plato's promise, Nietzsche's betrayal, Foucault's ambition. a ring on Joyce's finger, a flea on Yates's balls, a knife in the Taoiseach's holes, a bull without insurance, a boat with spoon-sized oars. What does grime sound like, crime, or fame like flame? Ball bearers of the wicked, beware the same, and shame, that weighty hurdle, cursing the words of those sheepish herds. Light, please, perfection's floor is revealed, that imperfect, that perfect floor, and that imperfect emerald is ignored. Suzanne, my blue-eyed fairy, in a daydream, mind you, but no mind. Mind you, the words may still be mine, but no mind. I have enough freckles to remember that although the sun is blinding and sips, the light is kinder, the seeking ear will find her that answer to unbind her. Is it really all that bad with so much to be had? Can it really be so sad? Invasion is a fad. Just what is it we eat these days in this maze, this haze of the age? Your taste buds should remind you of TV wars, didactic boards, information stores, cultural stores, closing doors, ethnic gores, fly-faced paws on all fours, scores of land mine, and floors, the greedy roars of armchair whores. And what wine to wash this down? High-jet beers, chemical beers, 7 o'clock beers, tectonic years, New World years, crocodile tears, Bush and Blair tears, uneducated heterosexual queers with paradoxical rears and mighty spears like garden shears. Isn't really all that bad with so much to be had? Could it truly be so mad? Isn't life just like a tadpole with a free thesaurus, an added chorus too? Is it really all that bad with so much to be had? Evolution and ages still go by, it's rare. I have stored, we have bored and floored, the fairy Anne nearby with sword, oars and all, and the prophetic fairy tying higher worlds with blue, returns with a warning, hued in blue. What's inside them now, PC? What's your audience going through? I dropped the sword years ago, you twit. I haven't seen the sight of it. Well, what's that thing glinting in your hand then, says I? That's my sense of humor, you idiot, says she. The audience thinks you're going to decapitate them, not me. Ah, bugger off, says I. Can I get back to my poem now? Anyhow, that's what it's about, my friend. It's every moment you meet, it's every second you greet. Have some dinner for six and some wine. Put on some Schubert, be fine. I mean, who's a poet arse anywhere? Go on, even you say, stop fucking around, arseholes of the world. All the good things are beyond your reach anyway, arseholes of the world. Because we new age, epic sussed, jazz based with ghosts of jargon are checking you out just to see. And those eyebrows may fail you. Politics of the day. Politics of the person. Politics of the culture. Hairstyle of the day. The French Foreign Legion, for God's sake. Art and politics. Where will it all end? Well, let me tell you a thing or two. Times we're in are delicate days. Crystal worlds of compromise are these. More books and films and music than the brow could ever read or heed. Rain is the rarity, or rain is the norm. What difference as long as we survive this storm? For in its eye the whispered promise of a better form. And so as we row with spoons in full flow onto those shores, without TV wars, no roaring whores or icy sores, We know those winds of envy may yet blow, making an eye near crow, so keep this extra floor, that blushing toe, that emerald floor, that sea-green glow, twisted hoe, toe in stir, we know those winds of greed will blow. And so, on we go. What do we really know? Is it really all that bad? Aren't we often enough glad? Don't you love it just a tad, this global village pad? American, Jap, Chinese, Euro, Afro, whateverisms. UN, equity, union, oil-based people prisons. Ice cream cones and 2070s roller coaster ride visions. Buckle down those highs. Doesn't it seem just too much sometimes? This is not the wrong question. Thank God for digestion. How else to escape these coy indictments? How else to arrest these hoi polloi infringements, singeing arrangements of opportunistic verisimilitude, trying to con eye, lest we forget illusion manipulation is an ancient game, see through just the same. The ignorant will maim, hardly an inch to this plane. Not a paying spectator in this light. This amphitheatre is full of peanut gallery shirts and second-hand birth. This amphitheatre of the imagination. Carpe Philos. Seize the love. Carpe Pomfret. Ardente. Can't have a rent, eh? Haven't got a cent, eh? Those anti-poet Pomfret will tell you that Mike is actually right. What a fright. A fight that's all right. Quite. Pomfret shite. Telling me how to shed my light. This moment feels tight. Tense, but not trite. Undo this mental blight. A warning to politicians and the like to not touch the poet's right, for you shall rediscover night, that lumberjack of might, and yet it seems we share sunlight. But I've caught a different flight, a rhyming delight, emerald of sight, my very own bright white height. Corruption to the world beware, this earth remembers more treasures than you could dare, and she's really fair to those who care. Is it nearly all that bad? We have therapists for the mad. We have prisons for the bad. We have hope for the post-grad. We have awards for the best dad. We have second chances for a wayward lad. Meaning for the pseudo-nomad. All this we have, in the short wisp of time, I find so many are truly kind. In truth, we're not too blind. We know the shape of Dylan's mind, and Oscar Wilde's behind, or what he left behind. I, the eye of I, will ire eye at this tie, 20,000 euro coy bribe too cheap to buy. I sigh. Our meaning is thickened by pie. A lover's sigh. Our anniversary is nigh, without drugs and so very high. There is... what is there? Hope. Fate's very daughter, by to light the way, beneath war-obsessed fools, beneath missile-guided ghouls. This I am greater than thou in hell. Eat your hell. I'm very well without that smell. The media fell into this ancient well, so ask it and tell, for me you cannot sell, no matter how loud your bell. It can only be that bad, if you think it's all that sad, if you feel that you've been had, not just because you don't like Roquefort salad, and so finally, and with texture, if I may, throw the rest of these words away before I cause you some dismay and earn too much of the dough, let me say. It's not all bad. Thank you.
Thank you. is impressive than entitled. If that, is there anyone else who wants to say a point?
Okay, I usually stand up for storyteller because I can't stand up for much else. This actually is a story that I was fortunate enough, out of sheer net and prejudice, to write a sequel to Waiting for Godot, where Godot turns up.
Yay!
Yeah, it was actually produced in the Abbey and has been translated into French, is going on in Ukraine at the moment, and Italian, and directly from Irish and But there's a story. I get so many rubles in Ukraine, but I have no idea what they're worth, you know. I'd have to go there and make them up. But during the course of the play, which is brilliant, actually, Godot turns up and he's asked, what's the meaning of life? I like these big questions, you know. They're easier than the smaller ones. And instead of answering it, he tells a story. And this is the story that Godot tells about the meaning of life. So there was this man once upon a time, and he was very confused. He searched through the libraries of the world and the scrolls of the scribes, but he got no answer. And he studied with the wise professors of learning in the best institutions of knowledge and got no answer. And he starved himself for 40 days and nights and even took little pinches of mescaline to open the door to perception, but he still did not get the answer he desired. So he decided to go on his way and walk from the top of the world to the bottom of the world in order to see could he meet anyone who might answer his question. And on his way he met an important rich man with money bags under his eyes and with golden threads through his hair. And he asked of him gently and with proper manners, "Kind sir," he said, "you're a man of the world. You go here, there and everywhere. You breakfast in London and dine in Montevideo. You have enough money to break the Bank of Monte Carlo or to play footsie with the stock exchange." That's a pun. Mm-hmm. "Would you mind telling me, please, what this is all about? What is the meaning of life?" And he looked into the eyes of the rich man and he saw the money dancing in them. And the rich man said to him, as he might say to his underlings, "Sorry boy, go away, I am too busy. I should buy another bank. And anyway, it's a stupid fucking question." And when he left the place, he heard a rich man laugh, and laugh shook the ground beneath his feet. And after that, he went to the palace of the king. The king was within, perusing a map under eyebrows that looked like moving forests. His fingernails curled like dragons on his abacus as he counted his soldiers. And as he perused with pleasure, his forehead took on the contours of an unconquered country, and his teeth glistened like burnished shields. And the man asked him with suitable obsequiousness, but in all honesty, "Your most worthy and inestimable excellency," he said, "you are the ruler of many kingdoms. You say to men, come, and they come, and go to war, and they go to war. There is nobody but that does not know. Bow down before your might and majesty and do your bidding. Please, please tell me, what's this all about? What is the meaning of life?" And he looked into the depths of the eyes of the king, and he saw power dancing within. And the king said to him with suitable royal impatience, "Be gone from here, you fool, before I chop off your head. Don't you see that I am too busy erecting monuments and defeating knavish enemies? And anyway, it's a stupid fucking question." And when he left that place, he could hear the king and his courtiers laughing, and their laughs echoed like trampling hooves on the flagstones of the road. And after that, he went to the temple. The chief priest was within, praying on his bended knees. And a man spoke to him and said, "Your most benign grace and utmost holiness," he said, "you have read all the books of theology and the scrolls of scripture. You know the lives of the saints and the prognostications of the prophets. You offer sacrifices and make obeisances daily. You fast and abstain. You keep the Ten Commandments and possess the seven gifts of the Holy Ghost and practice the cardinal virtues. Can you please, please, please tell me what this is all about? What is the meaning of life?" And he peered down into the eyes of the chief priest, and he saw sanctity and holiness dancing madly in them. And the chief priest said to him with authority, "Depart from me before I set the faithful upon you. Dost thou not see that I am too busy adoring God? I have to make reparations for the sins of the world. And anyway, it's a stupid fucking question. And when he left that place with a troubled heart, he heard a chief priest laughing, and his laugh drew echoes down from the speedwell blue of the sky. And outside of the temple, he saw a small boy begging. "Help me," said the boy. "I've nothing to drink for 3 days, and I'm dying of thirst." And when the man saw the wretchedness of the boy, he cried bitterly. And he filled a cup with his tears, and he gave it to the boy, and the boy drank it and was grateful. And now I ask you, which of these people did most good, the men who laughed or the man who cried? Yeah.